disappeared as a moral dilemma, cause at first it was weird, though I swore to eliminate the worst of the plague that devoured humanity. It's true, I was vague on the how, so how can it be that you have shown me the light? It's a brand new day, and the sun is high. All the birds are singing that you're gonna die. How I hesitated, now I wonder why. It's a brand new day.
This is Comics Therapy, Episode 7. No reviews, just analysis. And today, we'll be discussing three books from September 4th, 2013. Suicide Risk number 5, Satellite Sam number 3, and our first DC book ever for the show, Forever Evil number 1. If you haven't read them yet, consider yourself warned. Also, what have you been doing instead? We're super late this week. You've had plenty of time to read. Anyway, for grief counseling, we talk about Volume 4 of The Walking Dead, containing issues 19 through 24. And you've had years to read that one as well.
Hi, this is Daniel Elkin. I'm a reviewer and columnist at Comics Bulletin, also a teacher. My nerd confession is today I found myself, during my graphic novel class, having to defend Brian Michael Bendis in front of a group of skeptical high school students.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Blah, 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 neither Aaron nor I is a licensed psychotherapist. We'll be talking about new beginnings and starting over this week. But not in a warm and fuzzy kind of way. But come on, you don't listen to this show to get the cuddly stuff anyway, right? As usual, you shouldn't take any of the following banter as serious medical advice on how to improve your life in any reasonable way. We're not great role models in the best of times, and certainly not this week.
In between segments, as always, your very own nerd confessions. Are you itching to get a deep, dark, geeky secret off your chest? Like, weeks ahead of time, you set aside money and count out bags and boards in preparation for new comic book day?
It's true, guys. Aaron's wife, Chrissy, sent me the pictures.
I don't know what you're talking about, but leave us a message and we'll feature it in an upcoming episode of the show. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. And remember, catharsis is cool.
If you're looking for us outside of the show, Aaron can always be found on Twitter at Aaron Myers. I'm usually at Andrea Schock. I promise I'm going to stop whining about moving by the end of this week. Maybe.
Yeah, right. And our show account is at Comics Therapy. I can't believe I'm going to ask this, but Andrea, how was your week?
Oh, no big deal. Just a normal, everyday week.
Yep. Okay, good. So
nothing
I can just talk about the week?
Nope, just normal.
Okay, great.
Uh-huh. Okay. Wait, no. Total lie. Giant lie. I can't even fake it. It's the worst week. It's moving week. I'm so stressed. I can't handle anything. Okay, I'm breathing. Everything is fine. The bulk of the worst part is over. And we are in the new house.
So tell me, how is the door and window situation? Like, what's your escape routes look like?
This is a two-story house. We were in a ranch before, so I've had to change my whole, like, systematic where do I hide from scary things and how do I escape from scary things. Like, I had to do a whole schematic. The most important thing to note is that we have a second floor, like, balcony lofty thing off of the master.
Mm-hmm.
So this is good because, I can leave it open always. Right?
Are you gonna put like rappelling ropes out there or anything?
I don't think I need to. It's not that high. There are trees, and so it can always be accessible for me to get out. This is good. Plus, I mean, it's very scenic. It's quite lovely.
Sounds like you've had a really terrible time. Sounds tough. But
no,
I mean, assume you had to pack everything yourself and you had to move everything yourself, right?
No, I had some help. I'm a spoiled brat. Everybody knows that.
Okay.
But it doesn't make the pain in the assness of moving like go away completely when you have assistance.
Sure.
Moving is not ever delightful. The end result is fantastic. I am not homeless. Everybody wins. But getting from there to here, even though it's very, very close, like it's just yucky. I don't like being unsettled. I am not a spontaneous person. I like order. I'm not obsessive compulsive like you, but I like everything to have its place. And right now, nothing has its place. And it's driving me a little bit bonkers.
I am organized compulsive, not obsessive compulsive. I like to be organized.
That's not a thing. You're obsessive.
Well, but it was moving week for me, too.
It was. How did it go?
Good. It went well.
You're not as whiny as I am, I notice.
No, this is because I didn't have to move. I just moved. We moved our daughter to her first apartment. And now we don't have a hugely messy, disgusting room, which was a constant source of annoyance for me.
Because she's a teenager and that's what they do.
I guess. I was never messy like that.
Because you're obsessive.
I don't know what that means, but it went well. She actually packed up all her stuff when she was supposed to, and we got a moving truck and got her into our apartment right before the rain started. So
excellent.
So worked out.
Now do you have like an extra room for more comics?
Maybe someday. But right now, we were able to move all the toys, all the kids' toys, out of the living room and all over the house into one room, which makes me even happier.
There's a continuing theme here with the order that you require in order to be happy. You understand that, right?
Yeah, but I don't necessarily demand it. It's just nice when it works out.
I don't think you have to demand it to still be obsessing about it.
Sure, but if there's a difference between obsessing internally and obsessing externally.
True. I need to work on that. I do far too much external obsession. Except in my house, we call it anxiety, and it's a giant no-no. And I really, very seriously need to work on being just vastly less anxious about the state of the universe.
It's hard not to, especially with your kids, to place your like fears and anxieties onto them.
Right. And it doesn't take much for me to have a fear or anxiety, as evidenced by, you know, all previous episodes and see also my whining on the Twitters.
But anyway, it's good for everyone. Like, Luke now has a playroom with all his toys in it, and you know, it's his room, and we got to decorate it, and so that's good. And now I unpacked yesterday all the toys. Like, we just didn't have room, so I've been putting toys in bins or, you know, I'm putting them in the storage area, and got all that unpacked yesterday, and we have like, just a ton of toys. So it's sort of like when you're three, it's just like Christmas again.
Cause, that's awesome.
Yeah, except for a lot of the toys, we remember why they got put away, because they're just annoying. You know, kids' toys like make horrible sounds and just drive me crazy. So.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Avi had a drum set when he was Luke's age.
Mm-hmm.
We do not, that was one that we didn't replace when he outgrew it.
Right. Yeah, you learn that a lot of toys are not for kids' entertainments. They're made to drive parents insane. It's like some sort of weird social experiment.
True story, because it was my mom who bought it for him.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope everyone's enjoying Kid Talk.
Right, we have a tendency to do that. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah, but it's nice to have her out of the house in so much that she's now has to learn a little bit of independence, and we've honestly seen her in these last 3 days more than we saw her in the last like 2 months, because when she was living at home, she wanted nothing to do with us, and now that she's out, she's gravitating back. So it's kind of ironic.
That's adorable. I don't remember doing that when I was that age, but I feel like that's a pretty natural progression, right? You leave home, and then home is where maybe the heart is, but also food, typically.
Food, and my clothes can just get washed, and right. I can just crash and sleep, and I don't have to pay rent. And
laundry.
Oh, all the stuff you said cost money and that I would have to work for, you weren't lying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm very pleased with all of this.
I still do laundry when I go home to my parents' house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a fair deal.
I guess that never changes, right?
No. So before we get started with this week's analysis, I'm going to indulge Aaron's fanboy nature for a brief moment here in a very appropriate new segment that we are calling Aaron's Inner Child. Because I can't actually let him talk about Jonathan Hickman every single week or Matt Kind or any of his other favorites, but it was really funny to listen to him try to sum up mind management with a time limit last week, wasn't it? So in this segment, I'm going to give Aaron 90 seconds to fanboy out on whatever he read this week. Unscripted, unpredictable. What's it going to be this week, Aaron?
Let's see. Okay, are we going?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So Infinity number 2 came out, and I get to talk about Hitman because this is my segment.
Got it. Which, you got 90 seconds.
Yeah. Shush. You're using my time. So Infinity number 2 was awesome. It was even more awesome than number 1. And I hate everyone who says it's not awesome. I ended up buying all of the DC villains covers because I was at the store and a guy was there buying up everything on the rack. So I quickly scooped up one copy of each because I got like, I don't know, nervous or weird buying thing because some guy was trying to take them from me. And I don't like it when that happens. So I ended up buying. And I bought, all those and they were okay. Pretty cool covers though. Let's see, I bought a ton of Action Comics back issues, and those have been really fun to look through. The covers are really the best things about them, and I love the old, like, Bronze Age, Silver Age Superman covers. I read Prison Pit Volume 2, which is the craziest thing you have ever read, and it's just so insane, but it was pretty rad. Speaking of Hitman, I read God is Dead number 1, and it was one of the worst comics I've read in a long time.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy and horrible, bad. Like, just don't even bother. So it's really weird. Hickman with me. Superior Spider-Man has Spider-Man 2099, so that was awesome for Aaron, 90s Aaron. And Avengers AI is so super cool. It's all about robots and the Vision and Doombot and all kinds of other stuff, so it's you should definitely be reading that, too. And I bought toys.
0.7 seconds left.
Phew.
Tell me what toy you bought.
Let's see. We bought some Hot Wheels and some more action figures. I'm trying to think what else. Yeah, just a bunch of different toys. Luke got some toys. I got some toys. We put toys up in the rooms.
Toys for everyone.
Toys for everyone.
Good. Very good.
There we go.
So we also have two great messages from Isaac Cates. Since this theme isn't really turning out to be new beginnings, this, at least the beginning part, is all about our kids. And we have an all-ages anthology book that we want to tell you about called Cartosia Tales that you should check out. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Well, we're going to play a message from Isaac, and then the video and more information about the Kickstarter is on our website. We're both big supporters of this project, so give it a listen, and hopefully you'll check it out and support it. The Kickstarter is happening right now.
Hi, my name is Isaac Cates. Aaron and Andrea asked me to call in to say a little bit about an exciting project that I'm trying to kickstart right now called Cartosia Tales. Cartosia Tales is going to go through 10 issues this year if the Kickstarter is successful. We're actually just about to get the second issue back from the print shop right now, so things are already underway. The project, Cartosia Tales, is a kid-friendly fantasy anthology where all the stories are set in the same world, and the world is one that we're creating collaboratively. Each of the artists that works on the book gets to sort of pitch in what they would like to put in the world, and as long as we keep it all consistent, the world sort of gets bigger and bigger as the stories get told in various parts of the world map. Actually, before we work on each individual issue, there's this sort of role-playing game moment where I take names out of a hat or draw slips of paper out of a hat or roll a die or whatever in order to randomly determine where on the map each one of the contributors is going to be telling a story. And it's only at that point that you get to start planning what you're going to do in issue number 3 or issue number 4. We have a core group of 7 recurring contributors, including myself with my buddy Mike Wenthe, also Sarah Beacon, Lucy Bellwood, Sean Chang, Lupi McGinty, Tom Motley, and Jen Vaughn, all of whom I think are really top-notch, smart storytellers and cartoonists. We've got a lot of different visual styles going on in that core group, so you see characters look a little different from one issue to the next, or from one iteration to the next. I actually think that's one of the cool things about the project. little kids get to see when they read this book that there's not like a right way to draw one of the characters, but instead a set of characteristics that the characters have. The other cool thing about this project is that each issue has not just those seven core contributors, but also a couple of big-name indie comics guest stars. In the first issue, you've got Dylan Horrock, the author of Hicksville, and John Lewis, the author of True Swamp, who are both really, really generous with the way that they helped us out with the world building. The second issue has Adam Kofert, the guy that draws Laugh Out Loud Cat, and he also has James Kochalka, who is, super famous superstar.
Our first book this week is Suicide Risk number 5. It's published by Boom Studios. It's written by Mike Carey, with art this week by Joel Jones, colors by Emilio Lopez. Tell me about it.
Suicide Risk has been Leo's story for the first 4 issues. This is a one-shot departure. It does a lot to build up the world. What world, you ask? In this story, superpowers are bought and sold like drugs with predictably disastrous effects. When powers are available to those with the means, corruption is an obvious side effect. There are a couple of catches to keep this interesting. One, the powers only take if you possess the ability to absorb them, and not everybody does. And two, as we learned in Leo's last installment, there's a much larger influence on the power structure, like alien reincarnation, no big deal. We don't know yet. And like I said, we're taking a step away from Leo's story in this issue because we're switching gears to a woman named Ada. It's her origin story, a chance to take charge of her life with these new powers.
So what have you... I have such mixed feelings about this series, and we had, even to go back to like to issue 4, I think we had very different different feelings after reading that.
Yeah, we absolutely did, because I thought the resurrection, past life, like whatever it is, I thought that shift was a welcome addition. I thought it was what took this story of buying superpowers and made it notable and different from every other buying superpowers story.
Well, I guess. I mean, to me, I already felt it was kind of different. Like, I liked that it was like a superpowers, I don't know, crime noir in a way. You know, a revenge story of a cop who goes out and buys powers in order to get the supervillains who have been murdering his fellow policemen.
But I feel like we've read that story. And this was different because now there, I don't know, since we're only on the 5th issue and there are so many unknowns with like Leo's threads kind of dangling, but I thought the new life or reincarnated life storyline made it kind of nifty because it wasn't what I was expecting. Because it went away from that noir crime cop revenge story that I feel like I've read way too many times.
See, I mean, I guess I could see that, other than it really threw me for it was like a 90 degree turn, and not a gradual. It was just a very like, whoa, okay, what? So I still think I'm coming to terms with like this big shift in the narrative. I still like the overall premise. Like, I do like the buying superpowers idea. And I don't think I've read it that many times, like, that I can really think of. I agree that it definitely doesn't feel like a unique story premise in that way. But it seems like if I have, it's been a while since I've read something like that. And I guess aside from the reincarnation gods, you know, coming back kind of thing, which I'm not sure where that's going yet, at least with this issue with Ada, it seems that another big theme of this book is that, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely kind of thing.
Right. Like, you think you're getting a new start to fix your life. You think that if only you could do X, then everything would be okay. And then the definition of okay shifts once you've acquired X. And in Ada's case, her power is I guess it does have a specific parameter. She can't make things happen, but she can wish physical things into existence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an awfully broad, literal blank check for this world. I feel like the other powers that we had been introduced to earlier were more restrictive. But I guess maybe that's not true. There's the other guy who can, like, plant ideas in people's heads, and that's a pretty broad stroke.
Yeah, they have definitely varying levels of their power, which I guess maybe also ties into what we read in issue 4. You know, maybe there's different levels of the powers, you know, of these previous incarnations or something.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked in this issue too, though, how it ended and how it was going through were kind of different things. But it really reminded me while I was reading of it, this story by, I can't remember, but it's called The Milkman Murders.
Okay.
And it's the same sort of housewife kind of premise where, you know, she's just kind of keeping things together until a point where she snaps. In The Milkman Murders, it's much, much different, but it definitely has a lot of the same kind of themes of people can only kid themselves and take it for so long before something has to give.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of interesting how Terry presents her in a very sympathetic way at the beginning. She's got nothing going for her. Her kids suck. Her husband's a dick. Her boss is like the worst kind of situation. And just everything is, she's so downtrodden and, what does her mother-in-law calls her a doormat, right?
Yeah.
But when she gets her power, it seems like one of the things that has happened with the references to the other characters who got power, they went through a hero stage before becoming a villain.
Mm-hmm.
And Ada doesn't really do that. She goes pretty immediately into Bad News Bears with what she is able to accomplish with her power.
Yeah.
And granted, her life is shit, and so she exacts revenge on people who deserve it, absolutely.
But I didn't feel bad for anything she did to anyone after she got her powers.
Right, but then at the very end, like, she establishes herself as a crime lord. She doesn't go off and, like, live peacefully just with, like, all the things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting. I think that's telling us a lot about the motivation to continue to behave in that way when you have the means.
Even besides this issue, I think we've seen that
right
throughout the whole thing, that the heroes are never win. They only get defeated.
Right.
The villains are the ones who are always successful and have everything. And even our hero in the first four issues is losing his moral center and his moral compass.
Right. There's not a whole lot to keep him from going, like, back to Leo. There's not a lot to keep him from going off in that, I don't want to say villainous direction, because he still is rooted with trying to figure out what the hell is going on. But the drive to use the power that he has, and for all of them to use the power to help them succeed with whatever it is that they're trying to achieve, is very difficult to resist.
Yeah, and that's a commentary on humanity. I think we've seen that real. I mean, maybe it's going to sound depressing, but I think the tendency for people when given power is not altruistic. It's like why our government has so many checks and balances in it and still gets away from us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not in human nature to lift up most of the time. You know, when someone or when a group of people have so much power available to them, they don't tend to use it for the betterment of humanity.
You don't think that there's an awful lot of, like, delusional power usage, though? I guess in terms of leaders, where the ultimate motivation is you think you're doing it for the betterment of whoever you're in charge of. From the outside, we might not see it that way. From the outside, we see the corruption of that power. But do you think, I guess I'm just making a distinction between, like, real life government, which is not
or the difference
Rife
between
with
like
superpowers, and then what we're seeing in this particular story where there's truly villainous intent. And
right, I think it's also the tendency of villainous people to delude themselves in that they are doing good or that they're doing it for the betterment of everyone else. That what they, you know, even though what they do is evil, it's still, you still, people have, are great at fooling themselves into thinking otherwise.
Because everybody knows what is best for everyone else.
You know, or no, even that, it's just, we don't want to admit to ourselves when we're doing things that are wrong,
mm-hmm.
and we can justify it in our brain, whether it makes sense or not, that it is, you know, that it isn't. It's why Superman is he's the embodiment of good in comic books. He's
mm-hmm.
also an alien. You know, he's not human because it's not in human capability to be Superman.
To be good for the sake of good?
Yeah, to be good for the sake of humanity.
Right.
And it's why Luther is the supervillain. He's the embodiment of humanity at that point. I think that's a very telling kind of trope in a lot of comics too.
I tend to sympathize with the villain who isn't truly a villain, who I guess I don't mean an anti-hero either, but that kind of weird middle ground where you're trying so hard to do what you think is right because you think that will help everyone else. And it turns out that you're the one who's delusional.
Yeah, but that's like every dictator falls under that.
Oh, God.
I think.
No, I don't mean it quite like that. I guess maybe that's a sympathy that I have with fictional characters in extreme situations, not historically. That's a super important distinction to make.
Okay. I know what you're saying.
I guess let's table that, and we'll touch on it during grief counseling, because that's one of the things that pops up more and more in the fourth volume of The Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And there is I have a tendency to feel sorry for the delusional individual when they're fictional. When
mm-hmm.
they are fictional. I cannot stress that enough. Because there are so many times where it comes from just, like, not knowing what is best. And then kind of in a tragic way discovering it too late to prevent yourself from making, or for the character to prevent himself or herself from making, like, a terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very common storytelling character development building block right there. And I think that we see that a lot with, or we will continue to see that more with Leo.
I tend to agree, and I'm interested to see still where this story is going and how it's going to evolve. If this is a long-term plan, I think it's good to have that kind of twist we saw in the last issue, and I think it's important to have a bigger world building, like with these one-shots,
mm-hmm.
than just the main storyline, because what the plot or what the story premise introduces it would be world changing in a very significant way, and it's good to get these kind of like little snippets of parts of society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How they're shifting. It also makes me wonder too, is it just this couple that have the technology in order to activate people's powers, or is this happening elsewhere in the world?
Oh, right, because it was exactly the same dealers
right.
that we saw with Leo.
So a lot of that is not explained too, and I hope it does. That has to get fleshed out. Like, how was this discovered? You know, was it government research and these guys stole it, or you know, does the government have a bunch of like super soldiers that they're, you know, activating? Or, we'll see. You know, we have to see where this goes. Well, you ready to move on?
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
Hello, Aaron and Ms. Shock. This is Camarillo Brillo, calling in with my confession. I have many confessions, and they're all probably really silly, but one of my biggest ones is that I often feel guilty not buying comic books of creators that I've made some sort of personal connection with, whether it be on Twitter or Facebook or I've met them in person, I feel like it's a betrayal not to buy their work. And it gets to be a little source of anxiety for me, especially as we try to cut back our profiles. So anyway, there you go. Thank you.
Next up, we have Satellite Sam number 3. It's written by Matt Fraction with art by Howard Chaykin, and it's published by Image Comics.
It's 1951, the dawn of the TV age, and Satellite Sam is a popular sci-fi serial. It broadcasts live each week. When the star goes missing, his son Mike investigates, and he finds his father in a rather compromising position, surrounded by hundreds of filthy photographs. Seems dad was quite the ladies' man, but now he's dead. In the background of that story, the show's future hangs in the balance. Mike goes on as Sam, but it's unclear how sustainable that is. He's a bit of an alcoholic, Mike, not Sam. And then the network is also having difficulties. Some of the players involved in the show and the network as a whole want to move the whole enterprise to the West Coast, and everything is a mess. Mike recognizes a co-star in the stacks of the photographs, his father's photographs, which he's become kind of obsessed with. A sexy, recovering alcoholic who recently found Jesus and restarted her life. But, of course, everything else is still falling apart.
So, besides this issue, what do you think of this series? Because I have a lot of mixed feelings about it.
I do, too. Some of them are aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about, before we even get into the comic, where do you fall in the Chaykin debate? Like, how do you feel about his art? Because I'll say for me, before you even answer, like, I'll say for me, like, I used to hate his art, and I'd say in the last year I've learned to appreciate it more. And I've learned more about him. Like, it kind of clicked with me, but it took a long time.
But
and I don't think there's much in the middle for people with him.
Why did you hate it?
It just felt so kind of blocky and sketchy, and you know, like it felt stale and stagnant. But I don't think I was really understanding his influences and where it worked. Like, I've read books of his that I don't think it works, but then I've read more of his, like, his own series is. And that's where I learned to appreciate his art a lot more and find out, like, it's also really interesting to find out, like, kind of what a weirdo he is, you know? Like for me, I think the shift happened when Black Kiss 2 came out. I got the first issue of that, and I went, like, what is this? This is so weird. And then I found, you know, I read up about Black Kiss 1, and why he had written that, and I got that and read it. And you haven't looked at those at all, have you?
No.
Yeah, they're porno comics.
Yeah, so that's not really my thing.
But it's not like porn in so much. It's so hard to even like try to explain. The first series was a commentary on like on censorship that was going on in the 80s. So he had kind of decided to write the most disgusting comic he could. Because he could, and it was an exercise in free speech against these whole, like, the whole censorship, and they're trying to do the whole rating system for comics, and just like they were doing for music.
Okay, so there's an element of that that I can appreciate.
Right, so it's interesting to read it in that regard, that it's him commenting on this, we should be able to do this, whether you agree with it or not. And then Black Kiss 2 is sort of an extension of that. I really don't understand why he felt he wanted to do a second series of it,
mm-hmm.
other than maybe he just really likes it to do that stuff at a certain point, which is fine, whatever. But yeah, it's pretty graphic.
I think it's interesting that you say that there's no middle ground with his work, because I guess I don't have particularly strong feelings about it, negatively or positively. It's fine. I would fall more on the positive end of the spectrum than the negative.
Mm-hmm.
I like the sketchiness, and I like the, I love the grayscale in Satellite Sam.
Is this the first, like, Chaykin book you've really read?
It's the first, like, creator-owned
Okay.
And so that's not necessarily a fair assessment of his work. I'm looking right now through...
Oh, I mean, his list of work is, a mile long.
Right, but, discount anything that he's done for DC, because I don't read DC.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly...
Not even, the Star Wars comics or, the late 80s, the Marvel ones. He did some of that.
Well, and he did a bunch of New Avengers, which I have all of those.
Uh-huh.
But that right there says...
But where he really gets, for the New Avengers, didn't he do New Avengers... Wasn't it 1954? Or
yes.
Was that okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where I feel like Satellite Sam, he works perfectly for this because
right.
His style is almost very era specific.
It is. And I think that's an interesting exercise in comic making when you kind of embrace the era, you embrace
the style,
but it's not just a reenactment. There's definitely a more kind of sleeker modern spin with this title specifically.
He captures the time without making it feel like it was drawn in that time.
Absolutely. It's very mid-century in its obvious influence.
Less about the story as it is in its creation. Because it's a weird story. It's very niche. I wouldn't tell anyone you have to read this book. There's very few people, I think, that would really fully understand what Fraction and Chaykin are doing here. And I don't even really understand it. I have very cursory kind of understandings and ties to this kind of era of TV.
Right.
And it's all almost secondhand. Watching, what is that, about Bob Crane, I think, the guy, Hogan's Heroes guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's 8mm or something like that. There's a movie, where he was a sex addict took pictures of, he was very into taking pictures in movies of all the women he was having sex with and orgies and everything else and ended up dead in a hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
So he's definitely taking the basis of that kind of story and making a kind of a mystery around it.
Right. But it's very, period, centered, because that kind of scandal doesn't only belong to the early days of television.
No, but this, maybe, and it's also trying to resurrect and remind people of this period of entertainment, because kids, and when I say kids, probably 25 or younger, really almost have no exposure to this type, these TV shows, this type, this era of TV.
I think 25 is generous. I think 35. I think, honestly, you and I are right on the border of kids who grew up where this was even accessible, where this kind of television was even accessible.
Mm-hmm. The only reason I ever saw it...
Because you're a nerd.
No, it's because I grew up so rural that all we had was, UHF stations. That's all that would come in at nighttime over the antenna.
But
so,
Nick and I used to run this kind of stuff, and they don't even run this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to go out and look for things like Satellite Sam as the show. You have to go and be a collector, as it were, of early television, because it's not there. There's too much new TV being produced that it's not run. Kind of naturally on any of the channels.
But here, maybe we're wrong, though, because maybe the current kind of generation, that 25-year-old and those 20 to 25-year-olds, are seeking out stuff like this. Tapes are back again. People want to record things on tapes. It's these anachronisms.
Who are these people? I think it's very niche.
It is. It's generational. It's hipster kids.
It's hipster niche, which is... I don't think you can make a broad statement about, your average under 25-year-old really interested in black and white television, more specifically, science fiction serials.
Right, but it's a pop... So it's a current pop culture kind of phenomenon of finding things that are prior to them and readopting them as their own, especially when it comes to technology. So I wonder if it's like, well, or VHS tapes. People are collecting VHS tapes now like crazy.
Yeah, because the 80s are really hot.
Well, just in general, like they look like it's a thing to collect, like to find like low print, you know, run copies of VHS movies that are, you know, never made it to DVD or something like that. You know, it's like just like anything, if there's any kind of scarcity, manufactured or otherwise, people will want to collect it, especially at least in the first world, because when we've got time. So maybe this is kind of like, maybe we're out of the loop. Maybe people do like track down, you know, old copies of 50s and, you know, 40s and 50s serial TVs shows, you know, because they're hard to find.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just curious why some things kind of reemerge into the social consciousness, especially when we have so much access to entertainment continuously.
I don't think this comic and the audience for this comic and the audience for the kind of niche-y hipster guys going out searching for these early television serials necessarily overlap.
Mm-hmm.
But what do I know?
I still find it an interesting story. I don't really feel that tied to it, but I still want to read it. And I guess maybe that's what it comes down to. Like, setting and premise and everything else are just sort of, you know, why not? Like, this is just a way it works with Jacob's art, and it's probably something Fraction is just interested in researching.
Mm-hmm.
And so you write a mystery story kind of framed around the Hogan's Hero guys, kind of, you know, it's life experience and death. And there you go.
So, like, let's talk a little bit about where this is going right now with Mike and what he's trying to figure out. And is it Kayla? His like Jesus loving co-star.
Yeah. These are all character studies. I'm not super like, I don't really have that much tie to like the show closing or the you know, the network going out of business. Like, I think those are more like just kind of historical sort of commentaries on what would happen at the time.
Agreed. I don't have much of a tie to any of the individual characters or their plights, to be honest.
Yeah, I really don't care if he finds out about who killed his dad.
So then let me ask you, like, why should you continue to read? Like, if you don't really care, and I'm putting you on the spot, but I guess it's just a general question, too. Like, uh-huh. Is it more than just a period piece? Why should you keep reading if there's nothing that pulls you in with an individual character?
Well, I think you should. I think the idea would be that you should, at this point, feel tied, at least invested in the story enough to want to find out who killed the dad,
mm-hmm.
what will happen with the show, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I haven't really been hooked yet. I'm not unhooked, but I'm not hook, line, and sinkered with this. And I only will. I'll see it through because I don't have to make that many cuts in my pull list every week. If I were making hard choices, like if I had to, I get, you know, 12 books a week, this wouldn't make my cut anymore.
Hmm. Okay.
But that's okay. I think this is a very niche story.
Yeah.
And it's either something you're going to get tied to, and I have a feeling it's two creators who wanted to work together, and they came up with a story to write. Whether or not it appeals to a broad audience probably wasn't a big concern, and it really kind of shouldn't be in some cases.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm all for that, because sometimes I'm part of the niche audience and sometimes I'm not.
Mm-hmm. I think this falls out of that for a lot of people. That's yeah, and there's, like, even in the first issue, like, some of the pacing techniques that it's, like, a show going to air, and it's this real-time kind of merging of discovery and people scrambling around and these different kind of time parts. It was really hard execution. I don't think it worked 100%, but it was really interesting to see them trying to pull off in a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things going on here that are probably why I don't feel like, oh, I don't want to read this anymore. But at the same time, it's not the kind of thing where I'm super excited and, like, jazzed to recommend to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. Right now, it would be a hard recommendation to tell people you have to go back and find those three issues and then leave the rest.
Yeah.
But that's what six-issue series sometimes are. They don't need to sell themselves in that way, but they'll sell themselves when they're really done,
mm-hmm.
for the most part. But the issue by issue is sort of, well, it's almost perfunctory. Like, we just got to do this as part of releasing the comic book, and then most people will read this and trade.
Right.
So, let's move on.
Hi, this is Tom Barnett, also known as TPhoto10 on Twitter. And my nerd confession is, I've never read The Watchmen. I've never seen the movie. Not really a big Alan Moore fan, and I know it's one of those that everybody says you have to read if you're into comic books. But that kind of makes me not want to read it even more. Got a bit of a rebellious streak, I guess, and when I'm told I need to read it, I kind of don't want to. So there it is. Thanks for a great show, guys.
Well, lastly, we've got Forever Evil number one. This is our first book published by DC Comics. It's written by Jeff Johns with art by David Finch and Richard Friend. We are making history here, folks. It's a new beginning. See what we did there?
Yeah, it is definitely a new beginning, isn't that right?
Yes.
So all the heroes are dead, and it's... more, it's the crime syndicate from Earth 3 have taken their place. Bad guys are running amok everywhere. Poor Nightwing is captured by the crime syndicate. I'm not reading the script because Andrea has left script bombs for me. But yeah, the DC universe is in a bad way. And I'll say for myself, I like this. I didn't expect to, but I like the premise.
So you picked this for our first DC book. Speaking of script bombs, I think that it was specifically because you know that I don't have the same appreciation for or understanding of the DC universe like I do with Marvel.
I don't think you need to, though.
The same league for me to discuss it because I don't have the appreciation for the characters. So, like, why should I care that a bunch of the heroes are dead and, like, aliens took their place? My knowledge comes from, like, much more of the, like, mass media versions of any of these characters.
Yeah, but that's why it's kind of cool. So all the Earth 3 crime syndicate guys are the, you know, the opposites of the Justice League. And... you know who the Justice League is. You know who the Flash is. You know who Superman is.
I don't know who the Flash is. Let me explain what I mean by that. Like, I've heard the name. I can tell you roughly what his costume looks like, and I obviously know what he can do. But
okay, there you go.
I don't know anything about him as a person, whereas I know some general stuff about Superman. I know general stuff about Batman.
You know about Wonder Woman.
I've got an interesting mix of, like, old Wonder Woman stuff from when I was a kid and then New 52 Wonder Woman.
Yeah, so that's good enough. That's fine.
But I've never read anything that The Flash was even, like, a passing character in.
Okay, but all you really need to know about The Flash is, what, he's the fastest man alive.
Right.
So, he's...
I've never found that particularly compelling, honestly.
Which is fine, but if you read, like, if you were a fan of The Flash, you know it's a lot more than that when there's the good Flash runs. But that's really, in this case, that's all you need to know. That's fine. So the bad Flash, still super fast, just a bad guy.
Hmm.
You know, especially when it comes to DC villains and when it comes to events like this, you just got to know the big beats. You're not going to get into the heart and soul of Ultraman. You just know he's a bad guy. He snorts kryptonite and he doesn't like the sun.
I don't think it's enough. I really don't. I don't think it's enough for me, and I'm willing to posit that this is more about me, because, like, it's always about me, right? That I have to have a compelling connection to the character to give a damn. And I grew up with my Marvel universe as the only source of superheroes for mm-hmm. a long time. And it's a bit like, bear with me on this one, but like finding faith late in life. Like, where do you start the process of learning about the DC universe? And like, how do I buy into this? Because it's not mine. I don't have any ownership on these with these characters. Like, I don't care.
Well, see, that's an interesting debate, though, because I didn't really read a ton of DC until I started reading comic books, you know, 5 years ago again. Like, I read DC stuff, but I was definitely the same person. I read mostly Marvel. Marvel was my universe as a kid. And DC was a smattering of, but I definitely didn't have any, like, long runs of anything. You know, like, I'd have Superman comics here and there or a few things here and there, but it was not what I was tied to. And it's still not my primary universe, but I just like to read a story for a story. Like, an event like this isn't supposed to be deep. It's supposed to be, you know, action and big things going on. And all you need to really know are the kind of the big beats of the characters. So that's where I kind of thought it would be a good thing to jump on and discuss about, because you don't have to be intimately tied to any of the characters in order to enjoy the overall story.
So then the result is that the two characters that I connected to and sympathize with are Nightwing and Lex Luthor.
Okay.
Was that right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's why I like this story premise. Without the heroes in this primary Earth DCU, the villains of this universe are the ones who have to step up and take it back. Like, I like that as a premise.
Well, yeah, because you mentioned Lex Luthor as a supervillain earlier, and of course, like, I'm aware of that, of his contentious relationship with Superman for, like, most of their lives, right? Uh-huh. But that the final image, is it the final, like, the sort of striking image of him saying, like, ah, where's Superman? Bah, we need Superman, bah.
Yeah.
It is powerful because here he is calling out for this nemesis. And that is a character moment that I can relate to, and that's fine. But I think that there's something about trying to get into a new story that has so much history that is very difficult. Like, as a new reader, to just pick up Forever Evil number one and say, like, okay, let's do this. Let's care about this event. And it's about action, and it's not about new characters. Okay. But it is still difficult to find those, like, touchstones so that you can get into it more, so that the action has some, like,
weight.
Repercussions. Yeah. and weight. Exactly. Everyone's dead, but if you don't care who everyone was, then it doesn't matter that they're dead.
Sure, but then you're never gonna... That's fine. I think there's a conceit you just have to make that this is the story, I'm investing myself in it, so I'm going to try to enjoy it. And if it fails to make me enjoy it, it's on the book at that point, because you're making the effort. If you go into it like, hey, make me care, a major event for either of the universes probably isn't gonna do it.
Agreed. Absolutely. I had quite a bit of difficulty with, like, the last Marvel event, and I should clarify that I'm being, like, deliberately obtuse with you right now. I didn't dislike Forever Evil. I'll keep actually reading it. I don't know about navigating the rest of the Villains Month things, because that is very character driven, and when I was looking at the list, there were so few on there that I could even conjure an image in my mind of, like, who is this again?
And the idea for that, though, is for readers like you. I mean, partly it's sales. They're going to sell more books than they have probably all year in this month.
Partly it's sales.
I mean, it's probably 80% sales, but at least the way they're trying to execute it is that, okay, you know what? I don't even know who Desaad is, or who's the Creeper, or why do I even care about the Ventriloquist? Well, you pick up that book, and you get to read about their backstory.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do have a little more tie to it when in the main book something happens with one of those characters.
Right.
You know, it's not... They do make that available to people.
Mm-hmm.
it's all a matter of what kind of investment you want to make into it. And at the same time, if you don't want or have the money to spend on all those side issues, you don't have to.
Right.
But I actually find that useful. I didn't necessarily like the execution of all of the books I picked up this week, but it's fun to read those backstories for a lot of the characters. And it's even better that it will then, those characters, in theory, will have a part to play in the main event.
But I guess to just go back to the idea of pulling a new reader in, I'm not being pulled in about any of the characters for, like, the main books.
Mm-hmm.
So if this was Heroes Month, honestly, yeah. I would be much more on board. If all of those one-shots were giving me some interesting backstories about the Flash or whomever,
mm-hmm.
just like a single first issue of a la carte, who do I care about? Who do I want to read more about? That may be more of a hook for me. I picked up the Batman Black and White.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a bit of a cop-out because of all of the characters. Obviously, I've seen movies and I've seen, like, the cartoon that was on when we were kids. And
it's
much more of a familiarity with that entire, like, world.
Right.
But something like that that went across the boards... And maybe that already exists. Maybe there are one-shots that would be better introductions. Or maybe I should just go through the first volumes of, like, the trades from some of the new 52
sure.
titles.
That's the idea of the new 52, is whether you're a fan of it or not, the idea was that you reset the universe. So
right.
people who are like you, like, I have no ties to DC. I don't know anything about these people. Okay, brand new universe, starting with number one, get to know the new version of these characters.
Right.
And I think that's a fair conceit. Like, that was fine for them to do. I think their execution in a lot of cases has been pretty poor. But,
which one is your favorite?
Batman has been consistently one of the best. Wonder Woman's probably my favorite. Animal Man and Swamp Thing for, like, the first two trades before they got into the Sprott world kind of crossover.
Wait, in the what world?
Rot world.
Oh, okay.
It was this, like, a mini event between two series. Those were two of my top books, too. Other than that, the rest kind of I dropped off really quickly on. Like, I'm actually kind of re-interested in the Green Lantern stuff, but... That never really held my attention, especially after the reboot. And most other stuff just didn't hook me. Like, I just didn't really care. So you know, but that's aside from what they were intending to do with restarting the universe. Like, I still tried out stuff. I still picked up a lot, like, if not all, like, almost all of the new 52 first titles. I stuck with them for a couple months and then just started dropping things as I wasn't interested. So, you know, it wasn't a poor decision, I think, for a lot of people. I mean, I've talked to and I'm friends with people on Twitter who got into comic books because of the new 52. Like, that, they saw it as a good time to start reading them, and they're hooked, and that's they're super tied to DC and they're super invested in it. And
so those are the people that I need to talk to because, I ignored the new 52 and didn't start any then. But like I've said, subsequently reading the first trade of Wonder Woman and the first trade of Animal Man, which I enjoyed. And I actually have, I forgot, but I have the first trade of Aquaman also.
Mm-hmm.
That I haven't read.
No,
but if
Aquaman, I read the first like two trades worth and it's good.
But if there are others... That I mean, I guess I'll check out the first trade of Batman. But if there's others that people have enjoyed, then I guess I'm interested, especially if it was a new introduction to DC that you've stayed on board with. I'm interested in anybody else's suggestions beyond those titles that we just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I have this big hole in my life because I don't read DC books regularly. And goodness knows, with the amount of unpacking and just bullshit that I have to deal with right now, I don't have piles of time to just sit down and read a whole bunch of new books. But hopefully, in the coming weeks, as things settle down, it would be nice to get back into like a regular reading schedule, in which case I am always interested in new stuff if it's quality.
Yeah, there's definitely, in the last 2 years of DC, there's definitely been a lot of stuff that is worth reading. There's a lot of stuff not worth reading, but that's my opinion, and I know a lot of the stuff that I don't think is worth my time, people love, mm-hmm. and are very tied to and invested in. So it's good to get the different perspectives, because something that will hook you, that didn't hook me. And I like talking to people about why it hooked them and why they love it, and maybe why I didn't, too. So it's very conditional with superhero books. It's like even more conditional than I think than indies in a lot of ways. Like there's so much emotion and usually a lot of history tied to why somebody likes a character or a series or, you know, a little portion of the universe.
Yeah, I agree, because there's absolutely, even when you restart a universe, there is no escaping the fact that some of these characters are 50 plus years old.
Yeah.
And there's something kind of beautiful and magical about that that history and that serial nature of character development, even if you are ignoring the past. When you're reading the now, that past exists if you ever want to go and investigate it. And I've always found that to be such a unique thing about the mainstream superhero books.
It's true. Speaking of ignoring the past and not wanting to talk about it, or talking about it, you want to talk some Walking Dead?
Yeah, but first, here is some more information about Kartosia Tales from Isaac Cates and the Kickstarter project.
Let's listen.
I was talking about our third issue guest stars, Kevin Cannon and Evan Tom. This is a book that I think is going to appeal to grown-ups who are interested in comics or who are interested in reading fantasy stuff. It's also a book that we're doing we're working really carefully to keep it kid safe and kid friendly. And we're doing stuff with every issue that I think is going to be extra fun for kids. Like we have some stuff in the first issue that's about how you can make maps of your own neighborhood and your own living space. And there's some stuff in the second issue that's like instructions for crafts. And we even have paper dolls that are going to ship with the second issue of a couple of the characters and like cut out and fold up a wardrobe for each of the characters that you have paper dolls of. We're going to have a maze in the third issue that you can solve right there on the page. Lots and lots of fun stuff. And I mean, my hope is that it's the sort of book that a parent can read with his or her kids, and both people involved in the reading are going to enjoy it. I would love to see kids sort of passing it around at school or whatever, teenagers even, you know, getting really into it. I think that pretty much anybody could. We try to approach all ages storytelling by making the stories compelling instead of thinking about what a little kid would like. That said, I have to say, I think that in order for the project to succeed, we have to start reaching an audience that goes beyond just people who normally buy indie comics. And I don't necessarily mean also people who buy mainstream comics, although that would be super. I think everybody who does would probably enjoy this book. Thanks a bunch, guys. I know Aaron is already a big fan of the project, and I hope that he will help us spread the enthusiasm that he's feeling for it, because we could use a bunch of backers, and of course the more money we bring in, the more we can do with the book. Thanks a lot, guys. Bye.
The time we're all here for, grief counseling. And we're going to talk about The Walking Dead Volume 4. So last week, Andrea admitted she didn't hate Volume 3. And this week, she practically sent me death threats while reading. And I got messages that she had nightmares, too. I guess she's still in the second stage of grief. That's anger.
A lot of anger.
Well, tell me about this volume. What happens in this volume?
We're still in the prison. And, there's more zombies. That was my biggest problem, I guess, is that we're back in that, like, there's dead people and zombies. I can't enjoy myself. I can't relax while I'm reading it. It's not, it's always going to be a problem. So if the story arcs ebb and flow with like people problems versus zombie problems, any of the zombie problem ones are going to be losers in my book because I fucking hate it so much. This is also the first introduction to Michonne. Is that how you say her name? Uh-huh. I know there's a show y'all watch with these characters, but I'm just reading them. So
just get like a southern. You became a southern gentleman there. There's a show y'all watch on that television.
And I have a lot of problems with her character. Lots and lots of problems. I was so stoked because she's introduced in such a strong way. She's a fucking badass. She's got like a sword and she's got zombies chained to her to keep the other zombies away. And then are you fucking kidding me with the blowjob with the other guy? And God damn it. I was so angry about that. So yes, that's where we're at with volume four. Oh, and Rick goes apeshit. And lots of people die, and there's repercussions for that. And like I mentioned earlier in the show, with like absolute power corrupts absolutely, but he had the intention of keeping everybody safe. He's just so delusional. He cannot separate the choices that he's making for the good of the party from like what is actually good for the party. And so in a way, he's more sympathetic at the end of this segment. I guess that would be like around issue 24 or so, after there's a big fight and he gets kicked out of being the leader, and he realizes a little bit why he can't act that way, but like not really enough. He's still very delusional, but like I guess maybe more sympathetically than he has been so far.
Do you think just the pressure is starting to crack his psyche too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean that's clear.
It's a good commentary on the pressures leaders have in order to keep their populace, you know, safe.
I suppose. It's more of a commentary on like the traumatic effects of, I mean, like post-traumatic stress disorder, right? It's the the physical manifestation of the terrors that they have been going through, and the fact that they are not actually safe ever, and kind of what that affects their day-to-day life. Like they're trying to create this life now. They've got a sense of physical security for the first time, and yet they don't really. And it's a tremendous amount of stress then for the people trying to keep everyone else safe. But I want to talk more about why I was like so angry about Michonne's character. I just felt like that was such a, it's such a cop-out, like, bullshit thing to have this strong woman come in and then interrupt the other relationships. Mm-hmm. And I was disappointed.
You think that was just poor writing?
I don't know if I'm willing to say that it's poor writing. It's a very specific choice that a male writer made for a female character to do that. And then for the effects of that action to be that the other woman is just like, it just,
do you think it was almost like he was watching, I don't know, like Maury Povich or something at the time, like it's that sort of like stereotypical reaction?
It was very extreme, and it was taking a bad situation like we just talked about. Everyone is stressed, and so therefore everyone is snapping. Little things set people off, and this wasn't a little thing. This was huge. She like walked in on this crazy lady going down on her boyfriend, and she snapped. But I just felt like you can take a strong female character and make them like mysterious and add it was exploiting the wrong parts of her personality, I think. And it made her, I don't care about her anymore. I'm angry with her. I'm angry with the results of her, like, presence now. I thought she was super cool. She walks in with the sword. She's a rock star. And now I'm done. I'm back to, like, hating all of them. And even my sympathy for Rick, like, he's kind of whiny. I don't know. I'm whiny, too, though. So maybe that's really the biggest issue, is that, like, I'm tired, so I'm tired of reading stuff that pisses me off.
But I agree with you about kind of perpetuating stereotypes in some sort of very kind of transparent and maybe not very inspired ways. But I also think that there is an aspect of, in survival modes, like when people are so numb to the world around them, like in battle zones or, you know, who have had horrible traumas exacted on them, people tend to act out sexually because it's one of the few ways they still feel. And I don't know if, and it's been so long, so I don't remember this exactly, but I don't know if that choice is as kind of maybe as poor as it might seem. But I think there is a bit of an insight there into how people act out when they don't, you know, they've been so traumatized.
It just seems so deliberately manipulative. And it was such a discount of the existing relationship, which she was aware of, that I am not yet able to accept that it was a stress, like a sexual stress acting out kind of thing. Maybe more as we read, that will become clear. I knew that this character was coming.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when she debuted on the television show, which I've never seen, but I remember that there was a lot of buzz, and so the name was recognizable to me. And I think it's possible I had seen, like, the image of her, like, chained to the other guys, the zombies. But, I mean, ultimately, I was really let down. And I felt like it was an opportunity, because so many of the other women in the story are not strong. And there's a moment in the, I don't know, because I have a difficult time telling which issue is which, but it's probably, I don't know, 22 or 23 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Like after they've kicked Rick out of his dictator status, and they have this council of four, and they make a big deal about the fact that it's all men, and that the women have voted for it to be the men who are in charge. And that is an intentional decision.
Yeah.
So we've got all of these women who are in very like helpless roles, and then we've got this fucking badass Michonne who shows up with a sword. And she just doesn't do anything new. She's just, like, exploited, like, every other strong woman in every other, like, male-written story.
Mm-hmm.
And just had a moment of, like, grave disappointment that was independent of my anger with you and the story as a whole and the zombies and, like, all that.
Well, I like hearing your perspective on this, because when I first read it, I didn't even think twice about that. And obviously there's the gender associated, like it didn't even feel like, I didn't even think of it at the time as this sort of restudying of the character, or taking her, you know, her down, or taking away the power that's been established.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good to get that perspective and keep aware of how men write females.
I'm trying to be a better feminist.
No, it's good, because feminism has a stigma, too, of a certain type of attitude, that sort of thing. But really, like, a lot of feminism is being aware of gender inequalities. And especially how, in comics, too, I think it's hard for men a lot of the time to properly write women and write good women characters.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that there are any tremendous expectations that you have to get everything right all the time. But this was such a key character introduction and such a key defining moment that affected both like this new character and then a handful of established characters. And man.
That was a heavy sigh.
It was, because I won't deny the fact that there are things about this story that as it progresses, I'm interested in. This is also the first time that they attempt to treat somebody who's been bitten. Mm-hmm. So like this goes back to some of the reasons why I didn't hate Volume 3, the discovery that they all are going to turn into zombies, whether they die from a bite or not. And now this attempt to treat a bite, or in this case, they like cut his foot off, which didn't work, by the way. He died anyway. But I'm interested in the, for lack of a better word, the world building of this zombie like apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
I hate you.
Good.
But then from a reader, like a female reader perspective, I was disappointed in it, you know, for those other like gender role choices. And you don't hear that from me very often. I don't think. That's not my go-to complaint with most comics that I read, because I'm willing to accept quite a bit of dysfunction and imbalance in traditional female and male roles and the way that they're presented in comic stories. And then this comes along and I was surprised that I reacted so negatively to it, but the more I thought about it, the more I felt like that just sucked. So, we shall see.
We'll see what happens next.
Hi, this is Josh Cruz, a.k.a. Josh Cruz Really, a.k.a. Night Nurse on Twitter. The one thing that I did come up with that I could confess was that up until a couple years ago, I really thought Facebook was the best social media, and I thought Twitter was completely useless. And when I was out on the injury from work, I started getting on Twitter, and it's been amazing. And, you know, it's just funny that I used to think Facebook was better than Twitter. So there you have it, my nerd confession. See you guys around Twitter.
I think we've reached the end of our allotted time.
Yep. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Well, thanks for sticking with us, everyone. One more time, you'll find everything your hearts desire at comicstherapy.com. Show notes, information about leaving nerd confessions, and further details about supporting Cartosia Tales. Thanks for listening to Comics Therapy, everyone.